This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Jason Clay, Executive Director of the Markets Institute for the World Wildlife Fund. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Jason Clay of the World Wildlife Fund next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The World Wildlife Fund has worked for over six decades and now in more than 100 countries to help people and nature thrive. Jason Clay, Executive Director of the Markets Institute for the group, says not just the country, but our globe must anticipate the effects of climate change and the growing demand for food or face peril in coming generations.
Here's what's coming. With climate change, the projections are that natural resources will, the renewable resource base, so forests and grasslands and ag land and water and mangroves, et cetera, will lose 10 to 15% of productivity. If we're going to produce more for those new people that are consuming more and for people who come out of poverty that, you know, those programs are successful, then we're going to have to swim faster just to be treading water. How do we actually get ahead of that? Another projection that's coming is there's going to be 1 to 1.2 billion so far is what they're saying, people displaced. At least some of those people are going to be farmers, but all of those people are going to be people who eat. How do we feed them when they're displaced? How do we know even where they are? What do they do to the environment to try to make a living when they're displaced? I mean, we're seeing the early signs of this with what happened in Syria. What happened is happening in Ukraine, what's happening in conflicts, but it's going to become much more pervasive as we go. So these are just some of the kinds of trends that I think we're going to have to deal with. What are farmers going to do when the average crop land or crop system is moving 20 to 30 miles a year in the U.S.? Where do you produce soy? Where do you produce wheat? Where do you produce corn? And where do the animals follow that are going to be fed? And if we know it's going to get hotter, we know that mammals don't do well in heat. Above 70 degrees, it starts getting to be a problem. So do we move the animals north to follow the grain that's moving north into the upper Midwest and into Canada? I mean, these are things we need to start thinking about. But it's not just those row crops and commodity crops in the Midwest. California is in a place now that they can't produce the levels of fresh fruits and vegetables that we have counted on them to do over the last century. Where's the next California in the U.S. food system? Actually, every country has a California in their food system. So what are people doing to anticipate that? The one thing that I think we could say with certainty is if we can't anticipate problems, they're going to have bigger impacts and it's going to cost more to fix them later. And so it behooves us all to try to figure out and identify what's coming and get started, get moving. We have to, in some ways with climate change, I think we have to build the plane while we fly it and course correct as the data comes in and gets better.
Jason, you mentioned where's the next California. What did you mean?
So with climate change and with both extreme events from fires to rainstorms to frost, et cetera, but mostly due to the lack of snow melt, we're seeing that California doesn't have the water to produce the crops that it has in the past. So the question is, where are we going to put it? Where is that production going to come from? California is still going to produce things. In fact, when we first started asking the question of where's the next California, the people that were the most interested in talking to us were farmers and ag officials in California about what they could do to start thinking about this transition. But I think if you look at California, our food system, it's like maybe a colonial house in New England that somebody inherited, and they added on to it rooms, and they added on to it indoor plumbing, and they added electricity, and they added all these other things. And then they had the opportunity to just build a new house. So we have an opportunity to not take a bolted-on system that came out of California. They had a lot of efficiencies in some ways, but there were things that they never, ever did. So we're building from scratch. What can we do to make the food system more productive, more equitable, et cetera? Well, could we look at a different business models? Could we work with a specific area so that the equipment isn't something that farmers have to buy individually and then use 20% of the year? There's actually a co-op that buys, or some group that buys, maybe worker-owned, that buys equipment and leases it to all the different farms. And the farms find that it's to such an advantage to do this that they stagger their planting times and their harvest times so that they can accommodate this. Well, you could treat labor the same way. And what if local communities, instead of doing school bonds to raise funds for building schools or adding on to them, what if they built food processing bonds and they put in infrastructure and actually took the seconds and what might otherwise be wasted, or the food that can't be sold fresh, or that the contract was exceeded by the grower and they have all this that's going to go to waste. What if they actually turn those into products that they could sell, create jobs? What if we could keep jobs in rural areas rather than, I mean, the biggest thing rural communities have done for the last 50 years is produce migrants to cities, much more so than crops. I mean, I'm one of them, but a lot of people left farms because there wasn't a way to make a living. That's not because they didn't want to live in those areas. So how do we think about the business structures here that's different?
In Fortune, back in 2008, you were featured in an article titled Fixing Farming and Feeding the World. And as I read it, you suggested that genetic engineering and large business were the key to both of these issues. Is that still your opinion today?
You know, we have an expression where I come from in Missouri, dance with the one that brung you. So how did we get here? We got here through genetics. I mean, we would never be farming. We'd never be able to feed. We would never have 8 billion people now if we hadn't figured out how to improve production. We're going to need genetic engineering to deal with all the disease resistance, the drought tolerance we need, you know, other things. This kind of micro plant breeding and animal breeding is going to be essential as we adapt to climate change. It's going to make us more resilient. So that totally we need. We also need improved efficiency, not just large, but more efficient, because you can have very small producers that are quite efficient too. But here's where I think the real challenge comes. Efficiency isn't enough if we're growing faster than the efficiency is becoming apparent. So with climate change, we need absolute reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. People are shooting for 50% by 2030. It's one thing to be efficient. Making absolute reductions, that's where I think we need to focus on where those emissions are coming from. And our research has showed that the bottom 10 to 20% of producers that are the least efficient, that's why I focus on efficiency, are causing probably 60 to 80% of the impacts that the global food system has today. They're only producing 5 or 10% of the crop. So if we want to reduce emissions impacts, water pollution, soil degradation by half, we need to be focused on the bottom, not the top, making the bottom better. And so we have some better and poorer performers in the U.S., but globally we have a lot of areas where poor performance dominates because they don't have a kind of comparative advantage for producing food that we have. So how do we begin to move that bottom in order to take those bigger impacts out of the system, either by helping them get better or by helping them transition into something else? Let me put that in a slightly different way. Today, we have $500 to $700 billion in government programs for ag, subsidies, all kinds of other things, insurance programs, et cetera, all over the world. Many of them, if not, I would say most of them, are helping produce what was important in the last century. What is important in the century going ahead is going to be food for sure, but also ecosystem services from farms, carbon sequestration, not just soil carbon or even mostly soil carbon, reduced efficiency of greenhouse gas emissions by having more organic matter in the soil so you use less water, less fertilizer, less pesticides, etc. Using genetics so that plants begin to recycle or take out of the air the nitrogen they use. This is already kind of getting to be on the shelf for corn, and soon it's going to be for rice and for wheat and for other things. So we need to anticipate how we can actually reduce our impacts in a way at a global level. So it's not just the U.S. No country, no company, no individual can actually make this transition by themselves. We got to work together. To make it happen faster, we need to share information. And that's maybe the most difficult thing both for countries and for companies to do right now, because there's not a whole lot of trust. But we all know more than any one of us does. And if we don't start working together, not about how we market or where we sell or how we sell or any of those things, but if we don't work together to reduce the impacts, then we're going to be trying to figure out where the food is going to come from.
This is a related question to what you just said, but what do you say to the community of people that want to push away from the technologies that we have today, push toward more organic and of an agriculture of years before?
So we need the production of food to have fewer impacts, full stop. And I focus a lot on the environmental side of this, but I grew up on a small farm in the U.S. We lived on less than a dollar a day. This was an unusual small farm in the U.S., even at the time. I know what that is like. And so I think we also, not just environmental impacts, but we need to look at the social impacts as well. We need to look at what livelihoods actually mean and how we can support that. But right now, the price of food doesn't cover the cost of production. It doesn't cover the cost of the environmental impacts, and it doesn't generally cover the cost of labor and farmer livelihoods. And so how do we begin to start pricing those things into the system? That's where I think we need to get more efficient, different business models, different market relationships. Don't let any food go to waste. If have whole farm contracts for food that is being bought, so that the farmer's not stuck with things that they can't sell when the world needs that. These are, I have never farmed with a mule, but I have lived in Mexico and worked with indigenous groups there and planted corn with handheld planters that went along each side, one on each side of each of your legs. When I came home from a summer experience of that and went to our farm, I saw them hanging up in our barn where they were used on our farm 40 years before. I mean, we've got to use the technologies that help us produce more with fewer impacts, and we can't be scared about this. I understand the importance of being cautious about some things, but we've also got to address this issue because a lot of lives are at stake.
Some very popular food companies today are openly pushing away from modern farming technology, much less those technologies that will be developed. What are the consequences here?
The companies that asking producers to do things that don't increase productivity and efficiency of productivity, if they're going to take that approach, then they need to work with those same producers and pay them for the environmental services they're providing by not doing something. But when you're dealing with half of farmers being 58 years or older and half of ranchers globally being 64 or older, you've got a whole lot of the production that's coming from areas where people are trying to retire, trying to figure out how to stop working, not making investments in the newest technologies and things that are more efficient. Instead of trying to get them to hang on and to produce more in those areas, why don't we give them voluntary programs where the government money that might be asking them to produce things inefficiently, would actually pay them to produce services, like reduced soil erosion, like carbon sequestration, like clean water, like year-round stream flow, et cetera. Can we begin to integrate that and to cover those costs so that we can transition some of the more marginal land out of production? Every time we do that, we find that the remaining land actually produced more than what the whole used to produce. So why can't we begin to think a little bit differently about this? But let's link those environmental payments and the products that are coming out of the same area into the markets, so that if you buy a ton of commodities, you can also buy 2 tons of carbon and you know, 3 cubic meters of water and whatever it is that you're trying to set up within that place. I think the farmer 30 years from now is going to be taking advantage of markets that barely exist today. And they're certainly going to be producing crops that they don't produce today.
In the late 80s, you brought about rainforest marketing and rainforest crunch. Are there lessons learned in that experience that today could benefit this idea of marketing sustainable farming practices, as you've mentioned, and carbon sequestration?
Yeah, I think there are a few. One is you need and don't take this wrong, but you need an honest, transparent middleman. So what I was able to do when I set up a trading company to buy from forest residents, Brazil nuts and other products that I then sold into the market, is I showed exactly where all the money was going along the value chain. And I showed where the waste was. And by focusing on the waste, we were actually able to triple the price we paid to producers who gathered Brazil nuts in the forest. Every other trader had to double the amount that they were paying to keep up. We actually created 250 jobs. And from those jobs and from 10,000 individuals in that particular state of Brazil, they actually took over political offices and they took over the state for the next 25 years. One thing I learned is that transparency is really important. We also charged a 5% premium on the export of those products into the global market. And what that money, we guaranteed that 100% of that would go back and actually create more of these processing plants and collection centers so that the producers would actually make more money. Well, we've proposed a similar thing, and we're looking at Brazil and some other places to see if we could, if we're not covering the environmental and social costs today, what if we put a 1% environmental premium on the export, the FOB export of those commodities that were linked to a specific problem like deforestation or illegality or whatever, and use that money to invest 100%, not back in the producers that are doing the right thing, but in the producers that are actually causing the problem and creating the barriers to market access and actually ruining the reputation of all the other producers. Let's use that money paid for by the consumers, not by the producers or even the producer government. I think we need to learn how we can use the system to change the system. And in that case, we were using the market and market transactions to actually change the value that producers got for their products. It wasn't a tax on producers at all. In fact, it resulted in a lot more value being generated at the production level. That's the kind of thing we need to begin to look for more of, I think, as we go forward.
What are the outcomes that WWF would like to see from the development of a new farm bill? Or in short, what are your priorities?
I think that humans on the planet, and so this will be relevant in the U.S. too, but humans on the planet have used about half the planet to produce food in terms of the land base. A little bit less of the ocean, but maybe with even bigger impacts than the ocean. Our point is half is enough. Agricultural sprawl is the biggest impact on the planet that humans have had. And that is where we clear an area, we convert the habitat, whether it's a grassland, a forest, a savanna, a mangrove, a wetland, whatever. We convert it and then we deplete it through the various systems that we have developed over the centuries, but especially with mechanized agriculture before we got into no-till, et cetera, we had big impacts on soil erosion, and a lot of that land was degraded and people moved on and cleared more land. We were like locusts eating across the environment. We need to stop that. And fortunately, in the last 20 years, we're actually using less land to produce food now than we were in 2000. It's not a lot, but it's significant. It's an absolute reduction. But we're still throwing the land away, and we're still clearing new land. So it's not like we're at a steady state and we're retiring. So our goal and what we'd like to see with the Farm Bureau is how do we retire marginal land? And one example I would say that would help create markets in the U.S. is if we're going to maintain the CRP program, which I think is probably the most successful conservation program the U.S. has ever had, bar none. If we're going to continue that, instead of asking or requiring farmers to mow that land every year, let it grow back into carbon and create a market for that carbon, or let it grow into grassland and create a market for that. But when we clear, back to your question, when we clear native habitat, which is what the grassland issue in the U.S. is about, we're having impact on biodiversity. We're having impact on areas that could never be cleared before because they weren't profitable. And a lot of the reasons they're becoming profitable now is that genetically we can now grow things where we couldn't grow before. But if we keep this up, there's going to be no nature left. So that's why we as an NGO actually are working on trying to find both market solutions and supply chain strategies and producer solutions to reduce the impacts of food production, because we know if it comes to a choice between a hungry child and a tree, the tree is going to lose every time.
At one time, it might have been said that environmental groups and agriculture commodity groups were at odds with each other. Have you seen that relationship soften, and has the World Wildlife Fund seen the advantage of all of the above and everyone working together to find common solutions?
I think that environmental organizations can't achieve many of their goals unless they work with people on the land, especially if those goals are around biodiversity and habitat. We've got to work it with those people that might otherwise cause the problems that we're trying to fix. We've come to find that there are a lot of farmers who actually agree. Now, nobody has a playbook for this, how this works, but I do think that we need to create trust. And it's odd. I don't mean between environmental organizations and farmers or ranchers and producers generally, but I don't see that producers actually share information with each other very easily. They still see their neighbor as their competitor, whereas they're both locked into a system that they all depend on getting better, both for their access to markets, both for their rights to produce, their license to operate, but also because they can actually learn from each other faster than they can by themselves. We don't need 6,000 steep learning curves. 2 or 3 is probably the best in the world. So we've got to work with each other. And I would just take that one step further, which is, I'm sure, hard and maybe something for 50 or 100 years down the line. But we can't manage the planet one company at a time, one farm at a time, one state at a time, one country at a time. We have got to start managing some of these environmental risks and issues as a planet. And that has implications for ag and how we deal with it. I don't know. I would just say one more thing, that I think every farmer who has this land has a right to farm, but they don't have a right to degrade the resources for future generations. And they don't have a right to produce the pollution that other people have to pay for in the short term. So we've all got to get this right. And we all got to be, I think we have strength in numbers, but we also we're all smarter than any one of us. So we can find solutions if we begin to work together.
Jason Clay, we want to thank you for taking time to share with us on this edition of Open Mic. Jason, it is Open Mic, and today you've got the last word.
Well, I would just say that, you know, 10 years ago, I was invited by Ban Ki-moon to be part of a COP where he wanted to introduce whether food should become part of the discussion on the climate COP. And at that point, it wasn't a done deal at all. And I think those 10 years where that has been delayed, we're way behind schedule. So my last word is, we got to start moving and correct course correct our course as the data gets better. And in general, what I found is that as the science gets better, we realize we got to do more.
Our thanks to Jason Clay, Executive Director of the Markets Institute for the World Wildlife Fund, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.